Tracy Gehry was born into a fortune. Her mom was a Pillsbury. Her parents continued to make big money throughout their lives. But when Gehry got her inheritance, she decided to give it away. All of it. Now she's helping other people do the same. How common is major philanthropy among the so-called 1%?
I think it's much more common today than it was in the 50s and the 60s. My family had over $30 million in the 50s and 60s, and so they didn't hide their wealth at all. They really enjoyed it. But they were very attentive about the responsibility of wealth and really sang because I think of the Depression. Money comes and money goes. So it's very important to learn to get a job, and it's very important to remember that most of the world around you has much less than you do. So get involved to make a difference.
You really took this to heart. In fact, you inherited a great deal of money and then gave it all away. Is that true?
Yes, I was told at age 14 that we would be getting, I had a brother and a sister as well, and that we would each be getting $1 million and no more. But imagine being 14 years old and being told this. They did it for two reasons. One, they wanted us to be prepared, but it also came with a set of instructions. We expect you to volunteer in the community because it's the way that you will build community and build understanding. And beginning at age 14, we expect you to volunteer 5 hours a week. But they also said, beginning at age 16, we expect you to actually work for pay. So it gave me the reality that no matter how much privilege clearly I had, that I had to pay my way and that I was expected to be part of the community. Many wealthy families today do not deliver this message to their kids. And as a result, we have a lot of kids in the top 5% who are living in an environment of entitlement.
I'm curious about this, the ways in which you see philanthropy changing people's lives, because you've talked a lot about isolation, and you can understand why. You have a lot of money, everybody kowtows to you, you begin to think that you're very important. Can being a philanthropist change that?
It depends on how you do your philanthropy. So I believe in community-based philanthropy, which is really donors and activists and community leaders identifying problems in their communities and then going out and solving them together. It doesn't need to be a lonely business. You know, what I learned from going out and doing a lot of site visits, there are low-income and middle-income people that have fantastic capital. That capital is just different than mine. So I might have financial capital and influence capital, but they have creative capital, and they have a lot of knowledge. And they also have community capital at a very different level than I do. And it's when we combine that capital that the greatest changes can happen. It also changes the lives of low and middle income and unemployed people to see people, for instance, today going to the Occupy movement who are part of that 1% to say, we care. We know that the country's broken right now, and we're here in solidarity to help some of those changes happen.
Well, I understand that there is passion to be found in the site visits. How do you get those people together? Because they don't have any ordinary way to meet, do they?
Well, the great thing is that there's now a network of over 300 community-based foundations in the country. And these are meeting places where people who are looking for money that have nonprofits and donors who are looking to redistribute their money and to find out about interesting opportunities come together and get informed by the staff and go on site visits periodically or attend forum and discuss together what's needed. And that makes it much easier to be very deliberate about your giving. So does online giving. Now people can really get a very strong sense of what's in their community by doing some online research. There are all kinds of new forms of philanthropy that are out there now in which you don't have to give money away alone. And it's a preferred way of giving. I think we enjoy the collective aspect of discussing things and thinking about, is this the right way to go?
There are a lot of wealthy people, or at least I have the impression that there are a lot of wealthy people who've never really had any experience of what it's like to be without. Is it different for them?
Yes, it is. And I can give an example, a very real example that I got just last week. I got called by an attorney who said that his client were high-tech folks and they had lived a very unreal life for many, many years. And they were having trouble with their son, been having a lot of problems in his life. And when I began to talk to the family, it was clear that there was very little bond between them all, a lot of distance. And when it came down to how much they were giving him for allowance, they said beginning at age 18, he'd gotten $125,000 of annual allowance.
Wow.
Now, this is just has no reality for someone. And without tutelage or without support on how to spend that money or how to think about it, they had no one to go to ask what was real. That kind of isolation, it's a tragedy for a family because it creates a lot of problems, you know, in the kid. And on the one hand, you'd think, such a problem I'd like to have. Yeah. But I have seen in many wealthy families and the level of dysfunction that sets in. Years ago, I said one of the greatest tragedies for our country will be if we allow our wealthy to become too isolated with their wealth. And that is exactly what's happened. They're disconnected from community need.
So I'm curious, with his family, did you have recommendations for them? Is there a way to encourage him to engage a little more, as well as encouraging his parents to do the same?
So I'm working with the family now, and so part of what I'm doing is coaching him. And what we're trying to do is to absolutely shift the sense of isolation of that family, but also give them some projects together. So the more we can bring them into community together, it really humanizes the whole experience. Thousands of people, of course, that are in the top 1% or 5% are involved in philanthropy at a very high level. They're also hundreds of thousands that are not yet engaged, I think, who are rethinking this. And this is a moment of great hope, because I do think that issue of feeling complicit, of realizing I didn't vote my proxies, I didn't speak up about public policy, I've underpaid the people that have worked for me, I've been a person who has really not done my share for others. Those are moments of breakthrough in consciousness, and I think we're having a lot of that happening, in part because the people in Occupy Wall Street are all over the world stating that they want us to be thinking and more thoughtful.
Yeah, I'm really curious about that. As a matter of fact, I'm curious to know what your feeling is about both sides of that. There is the 1%, if it is indeed 1%, at whom fingers are being pointed, and you deal with a lot of them in the question of how generous they're willing to be. I'm curious about the 99%. Is it hard for the 99% to have any sympathy at all for the 1%?
It's my belief, actually, that the schism is in some way not as useful as everyone assuming responsibility for their part in the breakdown of the system. And what I'm finding is that people in the top 1%, first of all, don't even know they're there. So if you have $6 million or more of assets, or $380,000 or more pre-tax income, then actually you're in the top 1%. And so, first of all, a lot of people that are there are saying, hey, the taxation, just as you've heard from Gates and Buffett and others, you know, really taxation of the top 1% does need to happen differently, and we're prepared and ready to do that. There have been people all over the country talking about that for a long time. What I'm seeing, because I'm part of donor networks, in fact, I was just in Denver a few days ago, when a group of women donors who are all in the top 3% went to Occupy Denver to bring not only donations, but to sit and to listen to the General Assembly. And so there's genuine interest in listening carefully to what is needed by a small set of people. I don't want to say others. There are others that are extremely angry about this, that feel that it's not fair to point fingers at the 1%. But by and large, I think most people who have 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 houses realize, hey, we've lived like queens and kings. There were no holds on the system. We took advantage of the system because nobody held us accountable. And now people are asking us to be accountable at a different level. It's very important that we respond. And the vast majority of wealthy people will tell you that they didn't think about what would happen to the bottom 99%. They didn't feel complicit. They assumed the system would take care, was taking care of people. It's a kind of idealism. Their 1% has been made on the back of the 99%. But, you know, I think we're now re-looking at policies and ways that that can change. And that's a healthy thing for this democracy. It's a very hopeful thing.
So walk me through the process. I mean, let's pretend, and believe me, it would be a pretense, that I had $2 million I wanted to give away. How would you help me come up with a plan to get rid of it in a way that would make me feel good and do the most good?
So the first thing I would do is to ask you a big question. What is it that you'd like to change or preserve during your lifetime? So it starts with your values. And then from that place of value, that place of great passion, how can we get connected to find out what's needed? That's where the real joy and the excitement steps in. So we can have our lifetime giving and we can have our legacy giving. And what I've been doing in recent years is reminding people that actually you might feel that you can only give so much now, but you might have a future inheritance. You might sell a house. You might sell a business. You might feel compelled, because you feel complicit in what is going on with this inequality right now, to sell your second or third vacation house. And you might think, let's contribute that money. Let's not give 3% of it away. Let's actually give 50% of it away. So I think this is a moment where a new level of thinking is happening in philanthropy that really is about the creative aspects of how we can redistribute our wealth and our power.
I'm curious about you. You gave away your money. You've done it a couple of times. You're clearly enthusiastic about this. The question is, do you ever regret having given away that money?
There are moments when cash flow is terrible, just like for everyone else, of course. You know, I work for a nonprofit organization. I take home $60,000 a year. I give away 40% of it. The cash flow is awful at nonprofits right now. You know, I mean, I have difficulties like everyone else around, you know, around living my life. And I'm very blessed. If somebody had told me that my sense of abundance as a person was going to come from giving away that money, which has meant being connected to so many people, I'm the richest person alive. I know thousands of people all over the world who care about justice. And that's the greatest gift of all. And I think my parents knew that when they said, get involved. This is about you creating community with others for a better world. What a great gift. Give me $100. I will give as much of it away as I can. Because I know in giving that away, there is a transformation in the relationship that happens between me and that other person and our sense of possibilities for the world. Absolutely. Go, baby, go. May we all do it more.
Tracy Gehry is a philanthropic advisor and the founder of Inspired Legacies. Her book is called Inspired Philanthropy.